From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Did you wake up on the wrong side of the bed this morning, or did you feel like you were on cloud nine? We all experience good and bad moods, but how much do we know about them and what causes them? I'm joined now on Please Explain by Randy J. Larson, a personality psychologist at Washington University in St. Louis, and by David J. Hellestein, the director of the Mood Disorders Research Unit at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital here in New York. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to my show. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Hi, Leonard.
So let's begin with a silly question. What is a mood, and does the word mood have a scientific meaning? Dr. Hellestein?
Well, I guess a mood for a psychiatrist would be the predominant feeling state that you have. So it's whether it's happy, sad, elevated, et cetera. So is it scientific? It's a concept that is... It's a phenomenon that we experience and define as people. So it's kind of a normal range that we have in terms of our feeling states.
Randy Larson, are moods totally psychological, or can they be chemical as well?
Well, I think they can be chemical and also psychological. I mean, that's the nature of being human. We're both, chemical systems as well as psychological systems working together.
So other animals don't have moods?
No, I didn't say that. I think that animals can have moods. You know, events that occur to them can influence their state. They could be aggressive or calm. They could be energetic or not. So I think other mammals can have moods.
Do you think that there is an evolutionary advantage to having a mood, David?
Well, I think that it has such a big impact on behavior that I think it's a way of centering the organism in its environment and then basically motivating it or helping motivate it to do different things. So I think it is central to any animal that really has a mind, I think, has a predominant mood that it's in, even though animals that don't speak obviously can't tell us what they are. But they can show from behavior what we would infer to be moods.
Well, how are moods related to emotions? Does one cause the other, Randy?
Well, a lot of psychologists would say that moods are emotions in decay. There's a sort of a fine line between mood and emotion. But, I agree with David that moods are sort of the background feeling state that people carry with them through the day. One distinction you can make is that emotions have causes. So you can say, I'm angry because someone hit my car. But moods don't typically have an object. They're there. And you might say, well, I'm in a bad mood. I'm not sure why. Maybe I got up on the wrong side of the bed. People will come up with an explanation. But typically moods don't have a cause or an object toward which they're directed. But like emotions, moods do bias how we think and how we behave. And in that sense, they can be functional or dysfunctional, depending on a person's goals at the time.
Well, that idea of waking up on the wrong side of the bed would suggest that there's a chemical aspect to this, wouldn't there? Because you wake up without any, even if you had a bad dream, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a bad mood. Do you have any idea why we will wake up on the wrong side of the bed or wake up just feeling so fabulous? Is it because we had a good sleep, David?
Well, I think there's a sort of normal set point that different people have. So, for instance, we do studies of chronic depression in my research program at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, and we see people who are probably in the 3-5% of the population whose mood is just chronically low, and doesn't matter why particularly. I mean, it's worse if they had a bad day, but that's their set point.
But when you say that, you're not talking about people who are depressed. You're talking about something totally different.
Well, no, they have actually a kind of depression called dysthymic disorder or dysthymia, which is chronic low-grade depression. It's hard often to distinguish that from normal, but they are quite different from normals. But is there a set point which is different from probably the average person walking down the street?
And then are there people with set points that are generally very positive? Those annoying people who smile all the time?
There are people who are called, what's called, hyperthymic, who could be rather annoying if depending on your own mood that day.
Well, my mood set probably is a little lower than theirs. What about some other factors, Randy? You said that we often can't pinpoint them, but what about when we're in pain or we're sick or when we're hungry?
Right. You know, I think that the dichotomy between chemical versus psychological is sort of a false dichotomy. I mean, you can have a psychological event, a failure or a loss, that then produces some chemical changes, that then produces some psychological changes, and that it's a cycle. I mean, the two go hand in hand. So I don't think, you know, we can really say whether one is stronger than the other, biological versus psychological. But clearly, if you think about trying to change someone's moods, there are psychological treatments and there are biological treatments, and they both work. It just depends on how you want to enter the system and have an intervention.
Are there ways to measure moods, comparing one person's moods from another, or are these totally individualistic?
No, I've written quite a bit about that. I mean, there are quite a few self-report measures. People can report on their moods using questionnaires. There are other kinds of measures that have been used. So, for example, people in a sad or depressed or dysthymic mood are often slower. Their actions are slower. So having people, giving people a piece of paper with text on it and having them cross out all the vowels, just measuring how quickly they work on that can be a measure of, has been associated with depressed mood. So there's other non-self-report measures. But all in all, people are pretty accurate at looking inside and telling you how they feel.
So if we're in a depressed mood, we actually, it reveals itself in other ways, in the way, in the efficiency, the quality of our work?
Sure, yeah, people are slower. I mean, it's not uncommon to hear people who are going through an episode of depression to complain about being lethargic, not having enough energy to get done what they need to get done, maybe not even having enough energy to get up and change the channel on the TV. Depression is associated with, in most people, with a slowing down or lethargy. Other people react with agitation as well and have more of an anxious kind of depression.
I know that there are days when people are just cranky, when everything seems to irritate them and they're on a short fuse, and then afterward they ask, why is this? I have no idea why I feel that way. But sometimes takes a while to get out of that mood.
Well, I think, it's a fascinating thing because different centers of your brain are actually activated when your mood is low. So you do process things differently.
So you may actually need it at that moment? I mean, those centers are activated, or are those centers activated because you're in the mood?
That's sort of a chicken or egg thing that's a little hard to distinguish. But if you take someone who has a depressed mood and show them pictures of sad faces and have them in a MRI scanner that can measure blood flow in different parts of their brain is actually functioning differently than the person who is in a happier mood. And it also returns more to normal when their mood is good again.
My guests on Please Explain today are David J. Hellerstein, who is the director of the Mood Disorders Research Unit at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York, and Randy J. Larson, a personality psychologist at Washington University at St. Louis. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and in a little while we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. How do hormones affect moods? Do men and women experience different kinds of moods?
Well, women tend to have more depression than men. Most studies that are done on depression, or most clinics that treat depression, about two-thirds of the people that show up are women. But women may be more expressive about their low moods. Men may just go have a drink at the corner bar or punch somebody or something like that rather than feeling sad or complaining of being depressed.
Although we do hear about PMS sometimes cited as a mood determinant. which would suggest hormonal change, hormonal variations affecting mood.
Leonard, one thing is if you ask women about positive emotions, it turns out women tend to have more of those compared to men as well. So, a lot of the research has been on negative emotions and depression, but in normal samples, when you ask women about positive emotions like enthusiasm and engagement and so on, women report higher levels of those as well.
What about as we get older? Are we better at recognizing and controlling moods?
Well, one thing we know with age is that emotions tend to go down. As people get into their 50s and 60s and above, they tend to have less negative emotion and less positive emotion. And there's several theories about why that might be the case. One is that people get wiser and they know what to invest their emotions in, and they just get better at regulating. There are also biochemical theories about that as well.
But there's also increases of depression over age. So more people have depression as they get older, and some of that may also be from aging and from, for instance, vascular changes in the brain.
Well, do we have to make distinctions here? Because we all have mood variations. Some days we're not feeling well, and other days we're feeling really happy, which is different than being bipolar, which might be those things in extreme. So is this all part of the same thing? Is this all part of the same continuum? Or should we make distinctions between mood disorders and the general normal variations in moods?
Well, there's a quote that I'm fond of, and it goes something like this, that, everybody gets depressed. It's just that depressed people don't snap out of it. Bad things happen to people, and we react to that. Reacting to these events is normal, but when the reaction becomes prolonged and lasts for weeks, and when it starts to interfere in a person's ability to be productive, to get their work done, or if it begins to interfere with their social relationships, then we start thinking about a pathology, calling it a pathology. Something's wrong.
David, how does medication affect a mood disorder? How do medications like Prozac, Zoloft, and Wellbutrin actually work?
Well, the short answer is nobody's 100% sure. The available antidepressants that we have all affect neurotransmitters, which are brain chemicals that appear to be abnormal in depression. And the simple answer is they increase the amount of transmitter. The little bit more complicated would be they actually seem to slow the system down and sort of normalize what was actually sort of agitated, hyperactive system, sort of like if you have a car that's not burning gas cleanly and it's revving too fast. It's sort of like a tune-up in a way.
Although they're not necessarily consistent. People may respond well to Zoloft for a while and then stop.
There are...
I don't mean to pick on Zoloft. Any one of them.
Any of the medicines can have kind of a poop-out syndrome, and the brain kind of may return toward a depressed state, and then changing dose, changing medication, supplementing. And I would also add psychotherapy, cognitive therapy, other kinds of therapy can help to return to a good state again.
Randy, what's a personality psychologist?
Well, a personality psychologist is somebody who's interested in differences between people. And so, that may be... just in terms of normal traits, personality traits, but for me, it's an interest in mood reactivity, and so I've done quite a few studies on bringing people in the laboratory and trying to induce them into a pleasant or an unpleasant mood, and looking at whether their personality profile predicts how well that mood induction works. So, for example, we have a slideshow that we have that's positive. It has images of smiling children and puppy dogs and couples hugging. And then we have another version that's the negative version that has pictures of sad people, injured children, and some really unpleasant images. And we bring people in the lab and measure their mood before and after they watch these films and see if their personality predicts how well the film, how strongly they react to the film. And for the negative mood induction, the largest predictor is a personality variable we call neuroticism. It's pretty normally distributed in the population. It's not a pathology. It's a tendency to be pessimistic and to worry and to complain a lot, that sort of thing. People who are like that...
You mean like my boss?
Well, we can all think of somebody who's like that. But people who are like that tend to react more strongly to negative events like our slideshows.
But if I want to change my mood, I'm not going to have to put on a slideshow every time to cheer myself up, am I?
I don't think so.
How do we do that?
Well, I think there are a number of different strategies really having to do with how people react to events that occur. I mean, you know, that moods and emotions are reactions to the environment, things that happen to us. And if we can control our reactions, we can get a handle on our moods and emotions. So there's a number of different strategies that we've worked on in our research for how people get over bad moods and negative emotions. So you know, one is kind of commonsensical, and that is working on the problem that's causing the emotion. If there's something you can do about it, taking action can make you feel better. But
now,
there are a lot of times...
If I could just interrupt a little bit. It's an interesting thing, because people often say, well, this is the psychology versus the biology. But I think what we're talking about here is really something that it has to do with how you think about your situation or how you respond to it. And I think that does affect the transmitters. It does affect the processing in your brain. And I think that's sort of what makes it work.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back to this and take calls. Our number 212-433-9692. Have I been mispronouncing your name? Is it Hellestein?
Stein is more correct.
David J. Hellestein, the director of the Mood Disorders Research Unit at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York. And Randy J. Larson, I'm sure I got that one right, personality psychologist at Washington University at St. Louis. Stay with us for more. And we're back with Please Explain with Dr. J. Hellestein, the director of the Mood Disorders Research Unit at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, also at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and an associate professor at Columbia in the Department of Psychiatry, and with Randy J. Larson, a personality psychologist, also called a happiness expert by some people, at Washington University at St. Louis. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Sue from New Canaan, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air. Sue? Wait, I'm having a problem getting Sue on the air. Oops. Somebody's going to have to come in here and take care of this because it's not happening. Let me ask you a few more questions before we work this out. Are bad moods and low moods useful for anything? For example, last year I talked to the author Joshua Wolf Schenck about his book Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged the President and Fueled His Greatness. Do you think that depression can have a positive side to it?
I think that it must have evolved for a reason, and I think that it either protects people from bad things or it may motivate them to seek good things.
And there have been a number of books about how a lot of artists have had struggled with depression, sometimes have been bipolar as well. But then we see some perfectly well-adjusted people making great art. So what would you say to somebody who said, well, you know, I don't really want to give up my mishigas because I may lose my edge as an artist?
Kay Redfield Jamison is a psychologist at Johns Hopkins, and she's written quite a bit about, and very movingly, about her own bipolar disorder. She's very much in favor of people who have bipolar disorder who are artists in getting their depression and mania under control. And I think her feeling is that they tend to be more productive if they at least have some amount of control of their disorder.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Robert from Manhattan. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. In listening to this interesting conversation, as someone who struggled with not bipolar, but you know, moods and some episodes of negative emotion, question to the doctors and the role of anger in all of this, because I find that a common theme of myself or people that I know that just address the question of how anger might be, and the unresolved issue of anger and the lives we lead certainly cause a lot of it, as a role in depression. In my own experience, I just found that seems to be just a common theme of getting into it and getting out of it.
Randy, do you want to start?
Sure, I'll take a shot at this. I think, anger is one emotion that men have more of than women. And, you know, in cultures around the world, studies of emotions typically show that. I mean, it's a fairly male emotion. And so guys tend to, have more emotion than women, more anger than women. Anger's an interesting emotion because it has to do with failure or loss that you then attribute to someone else. Someone caused this failure or loss, and in the response to that kind of situation is anger. And it can persist for a long time, and it has, you know, research has shown it has a lot of negative consequences. For example, that the type A personality disorder, a component of it is this anger proneness, where people, when they're frustrated, respond with anger, and it turns out that's the deadly component, the part that's most associated with coronary disease. So anger can have some long-term negative consequences, as well as some short-term ones in terms of its effects on your relationships.
Do you want to add to that?
Well, I think it's a key aspect of depression. I think that better managing the issues related to anger and better managing the feeling of anger is likely to help with managing depression. I don't know if Randy has thoughts about how, if you can deal with your depression better, it would help you get out of, I believe, your anger better, it would help you be less depressed.
I think that some of the consequences of cognitive therapy for depression can also help with anger. So by teaching people how to reframe events, how to not take things so personally, how to not blow things out of proportion, these kinds of cognitive retraining for depression can also generalize to anger and work to, you know, mediate both of those.
We have a caller who wants to know more about cognitive therapy. Anina?
Yeah, hi. Hi. Oh, God, I have a gazillion questions. I'll try to make just one. My question with cognitive therapy was, I'm getting driven crazy by hearing my voice. I'm just going to...
Yeah, turn off the radio.
Okay, here we go. There we go. Years ago, I read something before entering into the wide world of antidepressants that talked about cognitive therapy as being one of the few talking therapy things that might help with depression. And I'm trying to remember, is that a question of changing the self-talk that is in your head on the premise that it might alter the chemical composition of what's going on in there? In other words, saying positive things rather than negative things and setting up a different, landscape chemically. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of it. I think that when a lot of the verbal therapies, especially the ones that are specifically antidepressant treatments, interpersonal therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, are really trying to change kind of inputs to the mood centers of the brain. And things like exercise and meditation and some other approaches like that are trying to do that as well. They're sort of ways to change the kind of overall set of inputs to the brain, and at the same, sort of in the same way or differently than antidepressant medicine, but having a similar effect in terms of changing mood. So it is, I think, mediated or goes through a chemical process.
Uh-huh. I wanted to add something here, and that I'm an experimental psychologist and try to study these things in the laboratory. And there's a technique for inducing mood in the laboratory. It was developed many years ago by a fellow named Velten, and it's simply called the Velten technique. And what Velten did is he put together 60 statements that are negative and 60 statements that are positive. So the negative statements like, I don't feel well today, I don't seem to have many friends. Boy, the weather is dreary today. And, you know, you say those 60 of those kinds of statements, and at the end of that, you know, you're in somewhat of a down mood. And the positive statements are things like, boy, I feel great, I'm full of energy, and those kinds of statements. And so it works in the laboratory. Just by having people read those 60 statements, you can put them in a slightly positive or slightly negative mood. But you can imagine if a person does that kind of self-talk, that negative self-talk, day in and day out to themselves, the kind of effects it would have over the long term.
We have Sue on the line now. Hi, Sue. Hello, Sue. Sue, are you there? Okay, well, I thought we were going to have Sue on the line, but okay, Sue, hi.
Yes, I'm here.
So what was your question?
My question is regarding adolescence and sleep deprivation. It's a topic of conversation in our community recently, and I'm gathering that there's quite a bit to do with, or there's a correlation between the sleep deprivation and moods, even though adolescents we know can be moody anyway, but that sleep deprivation can actually exacerbate this problem.
Well, sleep
I'll make
is
a comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I think that sleep deprivation can make things worse. You know, sometimes there's an event that occurs, a person's anxious about something, they have trouble sleeping. The next day they're tired, they're feeling low energy, which maybe makes them even more anxious that they might not be able to deal with the challenges of the day, and then they have trouble sleeping again that night, and it creates a vicious cycle. And so, you know, one way to try to break that is to just have a regular sleep schedule where you get people back on sleeping normally, getting their 8 hours, and that can often help the person have the energy to cope with the things that are making them anxious.
I would say something which is that sleep is a really key part of the regulation of the mood system. So actually there's studies that show that if you have someone who's depressed, if you keep them up all night, if you do sort of sleep deprivation on a short-term basis, you may actually pop them out of their depressed mood. At the same time, chronic sleep deprivation is a stressor that can make people more depressed over time. And then also people who sleep excessively or who have a very chaotic sleep-wake cycle are very susceptible to depression as well.
Okay, thank you for your call. Mark from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, I actually also have a question about sleep. I'm wondering, do moods transfer over between when you're asleep and when you're awake? And I guess I asked this because I have a short anecdote. I was once sleeping in a car next to a friend, and he was flicking my ear, and I woke up, and it was all I could do to not punch him. And I just don't understand it because I'm not normally like that. But it seemed like something had kind of gone between sleep and awake.
Either of you want to answer that?
Well, I think that maybe that falls into the category of emotion, that you may have had a stimulus that you weren't aware of, but that you were, roused to basically a rageful response, even though you weren't necessarily consciously aware of it.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Charles from Katona. Hi, Charles. Yes, Charles.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. I was interested to know if they've identified any nutrients that can penetrate the blood-brain barrier that can affect either memory or mood, have a positive effect on the brain.
Well, there's some research that's been conducted by a psychologist at University of California at Long Beach, Robert Thayer. He did some experiments on sugar ingestion, having people eat a sugary snack and then tracking their mood over time. And he didn't do any biochemical measurements, but he simply he would have a control group who didn't eat the sugary snack and another group who went for a brisk walk. And he found that the sugary snack produced an uplift in mood within 20 minutes, but followed by a crash about 60 minutes later. So, you know, so sugar is one nutrient that crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Well, also, there's obviously things like St. John's wort and omega-3 fatty acids, and there's a lot of things that are in the nutrient or food-related or herbal-related area, which have been shown to affect mood. The the literature for demonstrating that they work as well as antidepressants is really variable. But there is certainly some indication, and those do go through the blood-brain barrier. Also, people who take amino acids, there's actually, if people are fed drinks of amino acids that are missing certain amino acids, they can actually have a sudden drop in mood. So there's our systems are very sensitive to all sorts of compounds that we eat and drink. But what works to treat depression, that's a different order of question. And most of the nutrients are really not antidepressants per se.
Let's go to Tom along these lines. Tom from Fort Lee, New Jersey. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you? It's interesting what you say about sleep and sugar. I have two medications that were given me by a psychologist, psychiatrist, I don't know which he was, but I got absolutely no reaction from them at all. One of them was Wellbutrin, which you will see advertised on TV from time to time, and the thing I've got now is Simvastatin. Are you people familiar with either of those and might suggest why I get no help from it?
I'm not sure about the second medicine. The first one, Wellbutrin, is an antidepressant. I'm not sure if the second one might be Cymbalta, which is a different class of antidepressant. But any one antidepressant only works for maybe half to two-thirds of the people who take it. So there's a lot of kind of fine-tuning required.
Thank you so much for your call. Just one more thing. Do moods affect other people? For example, a person comes into the office in a cranky mood, but everybody else is in a good mood and changes, or vice versa?
Well, sure. There's a phenomenon called there's a couple things. One is facial mimicry. Sometimes when you see a person smile, a smile will flash across your face. And that's been shown in social situations that people mimic the expressions of others around them. And it can set up what's called social contagion, a mood that can spread through a group fairly quickly. So, yes, somebody who shows up in a really bad mood can potentially influence the group that they work in.
And what would that suggest about us physically? Is there something that's happening in our bodies, or is it just that we want to go, we're so social that we'll go into a bad mood because other people are in bad moods?
Well, I think if you're thinking kind of in terms of evolution, moods are a means of communication, and it's not surprising to think that they would be communicated one to the other. There's actually cells in our brain called mirror neurons, which actually get set off when, if I see you have a certain response, those will get set off in my brain. So that may account for this kind of phenomenon.
And there's been research recently into how they work with something like autism, where often social clues are not picked up by people who are autistic because of differences in their mirror neurons.
It certainly makes you realize that the idea of sympathy is not just a psychological, it's also not only biochemical, but it's also biochemical.
And I want to thank both of our guests today, Dr. Jay Hellestein, of the director of the Mood Disorders Research Unit at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, also with the New York State Psychiatric Institute and associate professor in Columbia's Department of Psychiatry, and Randy J. Larson, a personality psychologist at Washington University at St. Louis. Thank you, all of you who have called in, and well, I think I know a lot more about why I'm in a bad mood today.
Well, have a good holiday.
Okay, bye, Leonard.
On Monday's show, some striking images from the Red Planet. We will talk to the scientist in charge of photography for the 2004 robot missions to Mars. And then a curator from the Frick talks about the current exhibit, Cimabue, an early Italian devotional painting. Also, critic Robert Hughes examines his own life in a new memoir, plus the legendary hit-making record producer, Bill Ramone. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Eakin with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. We had help today from Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, Gabrielle Galanek, and Tess Hartman. Rob Christensen was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.